for your many provisions in our lives, how you've blessed each and every one of us in myriad ways. God, we ask that you would make us more mindful of those blessings in our lives and the responsibilities that we have with them. Please bless this time and this communication. Amen. Last Sunday, Ray spent a great deal of time speaking specifically about money in God's paradigm, or rather, how we should view money based on what God's provided. This week, we're going to spend a little bit more time talking about the different subjects that we'll be covering over the next number of weeks, how they interrelate, and how they relate specifically to what Ray talked about last week. You all should have a handout that has a brief outline with a number of blank spaces, so hopefully you've brought your pens so we can fill these in. The structure that I kind of want to take with this is not only covering those things as far as how we're going to go over them in the coming weeks, but start to give small, bite-sized assignments that maybe people can do at home with their families, or if there is no family, by yourself, or if you're a young person, you can start thinking about these things. Because it's going to be crucial over the coming weeks as we go over the different specific subjects of wealth, prosperity, debt, stewardship, and budgeting, that we have a framework to work within so that you've thought about specifically how these things apply to yourself. What are the things that you want to be doing with your money? Where are you currently at? Things of that nature. So we're going to have some assignments today. Hopefully you'll be able to take some time with your family as we go on to tackle this. Also, as Les knows, there was an email that went out late last night that has a couple of worksheets that I won't actually be covering today in class, but they'll go along with some of those action items that we're going to talk about today. So when you get home, don't rush off right now, but just get excited. In your email inbox, there are financial documents waiting for you. So, wow. Killer. I recently read a book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Has anybody read Confessions of an Economic Hitman? See, for accountants, when there's books out there about economics and hitmen, we get excited. It's like Clancy for nerds. The author was writing about how over the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, he was part of a major multinational corporation that would go into second and third world countries and convince the leaders of those countries to invest in infrastructure, which sounds like a good thing. But he would tweak the economic models or the return that those countries would get from investing in that infrastructure in such a way that they would never be able to achieve the return that he was suggesting. But based on his data, they would go to the International Monetary Fund or to different world banks, and they would borrow huge sums of money and basically put themselves in a hole that they would never get out of. His hypothesis was that once a country had done that, they really only had one option in future, and that was to play ball with the United States. So if the United States needed something from that country in the future, the United States, since they were a major player in the world banks and the monetary funds, they could go to those countries and say, well, you've got these billions of dollars of debt that you're dealing with, and we might be able to work something out if you let us put a military base in your country, or if you turn a blind eye, if we do X, Y, or Z, things like that. I'm not saying necessarily that everything in that book was completely accurate, and if any of you do rush out because you're excited about numbers and you think, wow, that sounds like a great book based on Paul's description, that you shouldn't read that with a grain of salt, because I think that you certainly should. I mean, there was a lot of tabloidism in that book. But having read that book, I started looking at how things were going with individuals in the United States. Did you know that in 2005 and 2006 in the United States, the savings rate for the average American was negative for the entire two-year period? There have only been two other years in history other than 2005 and 2006 where saving rates have been negative. Does anybody know which years those might have been?
27 and 28.
27 and 28 were actually decent years. 29 was when everything turned. It was 33 and 34. So at the end of the Depression, when people had basically sold off everything that they had, there were no other options available to them, they were in dire straits, and they started borrowing to cover the expenses that they had incurred in our lives. I hope that we can all realize that the situation in 2005 and 2006 was slightly different than the situation that people were in probably in 1933 and 34. I mean, does that seem like a fair assumption? So there's something going on that's a little bit different. And yet we know from the Bible that money's always been a temptation and a source of anxiety for people. What I saw in 2005 and 2006, or when I read this book, was it seemed like a lot of people were getting themselves into situations, much like these third world countries or second world countries that were described in this book, where they just get behind the eight ball and they try to catch up and they try to catch up. But the more they tried, the more that they kind of fell behind. And so we want to make sure that as we go through this, we not only have the right framework and the right perspective, but that maybe we have some tools to go forward so that we can make sure that we can either help people that we know that are in situations where they're continually falling behind, getting into some of the traps that they're falling into, the enticements of the credit cards or whatever they may be, but also for our own lives so that we have a clear financial roadmap to work with. One of the other things Ray talked about last week was one of the books he brought up was a Crown Financial Ministry book, written by Howard Dayton. Since that book was written, Crown Financial Ministries has ballooned into a huge organization. In fact, I think that they're the largest Christian counselors as far as money is concerned in the nation right now. And they have come out with the 2000 version of a book, which is a bunch of CD-ROMs and exciting things. And you can go to the websites and download budget forms. But they have a little roadmap here that describes step by step, maybe some of the steps that people can go through to kind of get to financial freedom. So I'll have this up here for later, but I just wanted to point that out. When we go through this, though, even though we're going to be talking about a lot of practical steps, it's all founded on the things that were discussed last week. And that is simply, we're simply stewards of money. God has provided the things to us. And so if we start from the perspective that this is mine and I just need a little bit more and things of that nature, these things certainly aren't going to be as helpful as practical steps. If we start from it and we say, you know what, this is really God's money that we've been entrusted with, and we have responsibilities with regards to that. So point number two, now that we've pointed out what to remember from last week, blank in our responsibility. Even though the savings rates were negative in 2005 and 2006, and I anticipate it'll be the same for 2007 when we get the numbers at the end of the year, we are in a very prosperous time in history and in a very prosperous part of this country and in a very prosperous country. So number two, it's prosperity and our responsibility. We have greater responsibility because, quite frankly, we've been entrusted with much more. Many of us that have lived here for a number of years have seen our housing values go up and then maybe come down a little bit. But, you know, property that we own is quote unquote worth a lot of money on paper. And some people are taking advantage of that in different ways or finding themselves in different situations because of that. But we need to realize, as the thank offering is going on this month, as we hear about different opportunities to tithe and to give money, that we have just an overwhelming amount of opportunities that we can take advantage of with that prosperity. But the first question that we need to ask ourselves is, where are we today? And that's not necessarily as a community, but as a family or as an individual, where are we financially today? What is it that we own? What is it that we have in the bank? What is it that we have in retirement? Take an assessment or take stock so we have a starting point where we can understand what we need to do. One of the documents that was emailed out last night was actually a personal financial sheet that you can look at and you can use as a framework or a template to really get nuts and bolts numbers of where you're at financially today. This, the sheet that I sent out was actually a sheet that Betsy and I had to fill out at the beginning of this year. As I was looking at purchasing another person's business, I started my own company this year. And as uncomfortable at times as it was trying to call up different places and get, you know, my latest mortgage statement or whatever it may be, where I just knew the exact figure so I could put it on this sheet for a bank, It was a profitable exercise for Betsy and I just to stand back and say, okay, bottom line, this is quote unquote our net worth, or this is where we're at, so that we could know, you know what, where'd this number come from? And, you know, if it's credit card debt or if it's car loan, whatever it may be, saying, you know what, this really shouldn't be there anymore. So we know that this is something that we're going to work on. And when we make a financial plan, this is something that we're going to work to eliminate. So the action item number one would be to write your balance sheet. And you can use that form that was sent out. If you're an individual, then simply for you. But if you're a family, you can do it with the family and you can go over it. Now, as a caveat, my parents are quick to tell me that they grew up in households where you didn't talk about money. You know, that was just taboo. And when I was growing up, when I was in different classes in high school and math courses, our math teachers, for whatever reason, would use a lot of real world examples, and they would bring up things as far as amortization schedules or rate of return schedules, things of that nature, so that we could start to understand in our math classes how money worked. And we talk about that at home. And I think that my parents now, as I've kind of moved into more of the accounting profession and career, I mean, we talk about a number of different things, but the one thing that they talk about is they wish their parents would have talked to them about the financial situation. And then they would, in retrospect, would have seen how it might have been profitable to talk more when my sister and I were in high school and could kind of understand finances of where things are at. For those of you that have had kids and had the Growing Kids God's Ways series, the authors have that one example in the book where he takes all their monthly income, the check that they got for the month, and he cashes it, and he puts all the cash on the table, and the kids come in, and they're like, oh my gosh, look at all this money. And he's like, yep, this is all our money. And then he starts segregating it. Okay, well, this is what we've got to pay to the bank, and this is what we've got to pay on the car, and this is what we've got to pay, and then what's left is basically a little bit of change. And I mean, what a cruel trick to play on little kids, right? Talk about incentivizing people to grow up and be homeless. But as you go through some of these things, you might want to, you know, do it at the table so that the kids have a better perspective on exactly how money works and how money works in the family. I know that the Crown Financial Ministries, it's something that they feel is part of the responsibility of parents with money, is that you transition some of your knowledge to your kids so that they understand how to be thoughtful with the money that they've been entrusted with as well. Does anybody have any other examples about good ways to bring up money situations within the family? And, you know, obviously sometimes we don't do like full disclosure, but what are some good ways to educate our kids? Jack's no good at it. I mean, he's starting to pick up that numbers are numbers, but I put a balance sheet before the kid. He cannot make a balance. It's discouraging.
Allowances.
So through allowance, you start giving the kids some of the responsibility, and do you make them pay rent?
Good.
Okay. Yeah.
Tithing.
So.
From their money they have.
Okay, so using that as a practical example of saying, you know, you give back your first fruits, and so that they get into that habit from a very early age. Yeah, John.
Our children are a little older than some, and so we've already talked about stigma. Showed them our trust, et cetera. I'm a successor trustee of my dad and mom's trust, and we've talked about those kind of issues so that they know, you know, where things are, what things are, what things are not.
Okay. So from those examples, we can see that this is an ongoing situation then, where it just doesn't stop maybe when they're 18 and they move out of the house, but we continue to educate them because we're constantly going through different situations with the different things that we have. Okay. So those are great examples. I need to call my parents and find out how much they're giving to me.
How much debt you're going to get?
I don't want any of that. That's for my brother-in-law. Point B on number two is uses of prosperity. Once we have a firm understanding of where we are as individuals or as families as far as the current financial position is concerned. One of the things, regardless of whether or not we're talking about spiritual lives, we're talking about our careers, or we're talking about finances, we want to make sure that we have a clear goal or clear goals of where we want to be. When we talk about evangelism, or at least when I was in Campus Crusade, we were fond of asking people the question of, you know, once you get to the point where you ask the person the question if they want to pray the sinner's prayer, and they say, oh, you know, I'm not sure, we would use the illustration of a boat in a current. That a boat in a current is already going downstream, and you may not choose to make the rudder move one way or the other, but eventually you're going to end up somewhere, regardless of whether or not you make a decision. Similar to what Ray said, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. See, even not making a decision is making a decision. And a lot of times, I think with credit card debt or with going out and saying, you know what, I need this now, what we're doing is we're putting ourselves maybe in a situation that's a little bit more difficult. But part of the reason that we do that frequently is because we don't have our money dog-eared, or God's money that we've been entrusted with. I'm going to screw that up repeatedly over this course, I'm sure. We don't have a clear idea of where that's going or what it's specifically to be used for. When Ray talked about last week that before you make a decision, his pastor in Houston had encouraged the congregation to pray about what it was that you're spending money on. Really, that's the transitioning of saying, oh, well, I would like this now, to what are God's goals, or what are my goals in light of my Christianity for this money specifically? It's the idea of thinking on a long-term scale. So with question number two, where do you want to go, and what are appropriate financial objectives? It's really two questions in one, but it's two questions. So it should be questions two and three. You guys give me a pass on that. Where do you want to go financially, and what are appropriate financial objectives? So action item number two would be to write down your financial goals and put them in a conspicuous place. Write down your financial goals and put them in a conspicuous place. Now, this might not be the foyer to your home, but maybe in your bathroom or someplace that you're going to see those repeatedly. I work with a gentleman who works with business owners and for non-financial reasons, so we have a lot of interaction as I work with business owners on the financial side. And one of his favorite quotes is, if something's worth doing, it's worth writing down. And, you know, I think that this comes from the idea of, you know, one of the first motivational books ever was a book called Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, and it's been published over and over again. And Napoleon Hill, you know, he's got this secret, and he's trying to dangle it in front of you. But the secret ultimately is that you write down very specifically what it is that you want to achieve, and then somehow that there's this mystical power that's involved in writing it down. And, you know, analytical people hear that and they start to cringe because, well, we know that there's more to it than that. But even if we look to scriptures, when we talk about what Christ says to his disciples, when he says, you know, you need to count the cost, he's talking about discipleship, saying, you count the cost. You know, nobody goes out and builds a home without having a clear understanding of what it's going to cost to complete it. Because if you fail to complete that home, well, you'll be the laughingstock of the town. So don't just say, oh, well, I'm going to be a Christian, and then go out there and say, oh, my gosh, there are consequences for this decision, these things that are going to go on and situations that I'm going to be in where maybe it's not what I counted, and then I'm going to sulk away and not follow through. But we know that money and finances are part of Christianity. So as Christians, we need to count the cost. We need to say, you know, well, what's the cost of stewardship? I mean, even if we go back to Cain and Abel, I think that we all face situations where we say, oh, my gosh, this is really nice, and I'm just going to keep this for myself for a little while. Rather than saying, you know what, this has all been given to me, this is all a blessing from God, and in response, I'm going to tithe, or I'm going to give that back. So we need to have an understanding that writing things down is a powerful way to keep us reminded or to keep us focused on how things are going or where it is that we want to go. So with action item number one, we understand where we are currently. And then action item two, hopefully we're saying this is where we want to go. These are the things that we want to be doing. As a church, as a congregation, this is becoming realized right now with the purchase of the building. You know, when I talk to younger people a lot of times, you know, I talk about saving up for that down payment. You know, if you don't have a home right now, making sure that you're putting money away so that you can purchase a home, because it makes a lot of financial sense to do those things. Similarly, Harvest has understood for a long time that there's going to be a stronger connection to a community, that there's going to be more opportunities if the congregation owns its own building. It's going to be able to expand. It's not going to have some of the constraints as renters. And so that was a goal that was set forth, and that's something that's been pursued, and that's something that the congregation has been giving for years. Even the use of UBS by investing a lot of those funds, you know, we've been using that money wisely, and there's been a return on that that's enabled us to take advantage of Dean and his time so that we could go out and buy a building in San Marcos. So these are all things that we need to be doing, but we need to have a clear understanding. Yeah, John.
You said the use of UBS. What is UBS?
It's a investment company. It's United Bank of Switzerland or something. It's a Swiss bank account, right?
It belongs to me, man. Manage your debt. So, okay.
Exactly. It's actually Morgan Stanley now, but it was UBS when we were making money on it.
Well, that was the broker.
That was, yeah, the custodian of the assets. Sorry, acronyms. But here again, as you go home and you're all excited about checking your email and looking through these things, and you sit down to your family meal today, these are things that you could be discussing with your family. Just like in the Growing Kids God's Way, there was an understanding of how money is used and what it is that the family's using things for. I would think that if you could sit down and you can discuss as a family, you know what, we'd like to pay off our home, we would like to save for college, we would like to, you know, we put money aside every month to buy a new car or whatever it is. And there's that education of the younger generation of how money works. Because I think right now, when I look around at a lot of my peers and those that are just a couple years younger than I am, you know, there are so many enticements out there. I drive a cheap car. And I just have to justify it to myself by saying other people make bad financial decisions by buying really expensive cars, especially if they're younger than I am. So when I go someplace and I see a 20-something in a BMW, I just think to myself, not being a good steward. I don't know that to be a fact, but okay. So, point number three. Destination one, and I actually got this from this financial roadmap, and I will get this emailed out to everybody as well. But I do not know. I mean, I like the idea of calling it a map, but anything that makes me fold a map again, I can't fold regular maps. Why would you fold other things like maps? It doesn't make any sense. They've taken these seven steps that honestly, having gone through these, read through these seven steps, we're talking about decades of work in these seven steps. So, A, this is going to be destroyed because, Lord willing, Betsy and I will have more kids. But, B, it's kind of nice that you can put like 30 years of work into a sheet like this. But I will get copies of this and put this out there. The other nice thing is that step number one, hopefully, is fairly easy to accomplish, or destination one, and that is to save $1,000 for emergencies. When I deal with individuals and businesses, well, when I deal with businesses, one of the things I generally advise them to do if they have any fluctuation in cash is to go out and get a line of credit, because they never know when there's going to be major things that come up in their business where they're just going to need money, and it's easier to get money for a business when you've already got it versus when you don't have it and you really need it. But that's not necessarily the case with individuals anymore. With individuals, even in spite of the collapse of the home loan industry to a large extent, it's really easy for us to get money. Betsy and I, when we first got married, we moved out to California without jobs. And so there was a period there where we were spending a lot of money on credit cards. And we were prayerful that that was going to be a short-term situation. And it did eventually end. But we were spending money on credit cards. We were barely making the minimum payment on those credit cards for a couple months. And you know what happened in our mailbox? We got more credit card offers than we'd ever received before. I mean, when they see somebody that's drowning, man, they'll give you a glass of water. So, one thing that we can do to counteract that is to be dedicated enough just to say, you know what, I'm going to put aside an emergency reserve of cash of $1,000. So before Crown Financial Ministries, before they recommend even starting to pay down your credit card and your high interest debt, things of that nature, they recommend going out and having that $1,000 put aside so that if there is something that comes up, if the transmission goes out on the car, whatever it may be, you don't need to turn to the credit cards again. So you don't need to increase the debt that might be there or start new debt. Rather, you've got that reserve that's there for whatever that situation is. And there are a number of ways that people can save $1,000 to put that in a reserve. Has anybody started or found ways in the past to build up cash reserves from the same amount of income? Piggy bank. So the old, if you get change someplace, you dump it into the bank at the door, and eventually that change will be worth something. Yeah.
Having a certain amount auto deducted and put into savings before I spend the check.
That,
like every month?
Absolutely.
So it seems like it's not there ever, so it's not intended.
That's right. So it never seems actually like your money because it never goes into the checking account.
When I got a raise, I opened a second account and had some of the money deposited there, so I just kept the same money coming into the regular account.
Absolutely. So anytime you get a raise, and Ray brought that up last week, that's a great way. You're still living at the same standard, but that excess is going to something else. There was another famous book that came out about the time of the Depression called The Richest Man in Babylon. And it's a bunch of parables about financial sense. And it was written by a very successful map maker in North America named George Clausen. But, to distill that book down even further, in essence, what they're saying is save 10% of everything that you make. And a great way to do that is to open up a savings account or another type of account where you can go down to the human resources department of your company, if you've got that, and immediately ask them just to start shifting that 10% over. Not only will that grow that $1,000 for your emergency, but it'll start building up a bigger reserve for you. The other thing that understanding where you are currently financially and where you want to go with your goals is it allows you to get better return on the money that you've been entrusted with. Ray brought up the parable about the three servants with talents and the person that had one just buried it. And the master comes back and says, well, if you just would have put it in the bank, you would have gotten interest at least on the money. Well, a lot of times people that never want to, have the embarrassment of bouncing a check or that, they really want to be financially stable, they put a lot of money in bank accounts. So they have a lot of money. They have a big cushion in their checking account because the thought is that if a big expenditure comes up, you could always cover it. And there's a big cushion there, but they're not necessarily planning, so they're not really thinking about where their money is going to go. There are ways that we can put our money into investments to get a larger return, hopefully. Even low-risk investment or no-risk investments like muni bonds or things like that where we're pretty much guaranteed a return. If we have excess cash, frequently it's more advantageous to get a return on that rather than leaving it in the checking account. And one way that we can have confidence and maximize that return is by understanding what money outlays we're going to have in the future. So we have an emergency fund. And then we have what's going to cover our monthly expenses, and that allows us to put more maybe into our retirement plan or more into investments and things like that where we can get larger amount of returns. There's a company out that does what's called money merge accounts now, where they encourage people basically to live at a zero balance in their checking account. But the premise is that you get rid of all the cash sitting in your checking account, and you immediately start paying off debt. And it works a couple different ways, but if somebody has a very clear budget and they know exactly what they're going to be able to spend, they will be able to take excess cash and put it against things like their mortgage. And when, you know, Ray again brought up that on a 30-year mortgage, you're paying about three times as much or two times as much over the life of your loan to interest as you are to principal. And then if year 1 through 12, you're able to put excess cash against that principal, then at the backside of your loan, you're going to be saving yourself, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars in interest on that. So having a clear financial picture of where you are and where you want to go is a good way to either eliminate debt more quickly or to increase return on investment. So action item number 3 would simply be to save $1,000 if you've not already done that. One of the verses that the Crown Ministry brings up for this is the wise man saves for the future, but the foolish man spends whatever he gets. And that's Proverbs 21:20. And obviously, one of the objectives is to save for the future so that we're not a burden to others in our retirement or, you know, to have an inheritance, as Ray pointed out last time. And then action item number 4 was Daphne's suggestion. And I would just say, have a portion of the salary withheld and put into savings or retirement plan. So get rid of that money before it actually comes out. For those that maybe don't have those options as far as like human resources department where you can go down and just say, put money, certain amount of money into this other account. Are there other suggestions or other ways that we can save money on a regular basis, routine basis? Karen?
Because I'm a very visual person, and I was the one with the checkbook doing the everyday stuff. We would have two the books that you keep track of your checks. We had two of them, and one of them would have how much we actually had, but the other one was how much I spent on the things that were under my management, like groceries and, you know, whatever it was, you know, Walmart stuff or whatever stuff that I had to spend. So that I couldn't see that money, and that helped me. So then when you're off, you know, shopping at the mall, if money's not there, it's not right in front of you, it's not in your checkbook, then you can't spend something that's not there.
Right.
That was helpful to me.
Could you explain that a little more fully? I didn't quite follow.
Well, for instance, let's say you bring in $1,000, but you're saving 10% of that, okay? So that $100 is never even put into your checking, your checkbook.
Check ledger?
Yeah, your ledger, sorry. It's not even put in there. So you're not, when you're looking at what you can spend, then you're not even cognizant that it's there. If you haven't put it away somewhere else, or you haven't, if your company doesn't put it away for you, if you haven't put it in a savings yet because you know you're going to need it for another reason, if you're just not looking at it, more of a psychological thing that helped me in the beginning, because this was really hard for me. Before I met my husband, I had closed a couple of checking accounts because I had no idea how much money I had at one point. So I needed to see things and actually see where the money was going. The other thing was, you know, if I get $60 a week for groceries and I only spend $54, then that $6 I get at the grocery store, and I put it aside. And when I was at home, it felt like my contribution to the family. And so I would do everything I could, using coupons and whatever I could to, you know, spend the very least, which is a lot of work when you talk to people who do it. Then that money I put towards the family income, and it was kind of that extra, you know, working towards $1,000, and now we can invest that money. Then we had $1,000 we could invest, and it was something that I put, you know, even though I know my husband's working, I mean, we're all working together, but it just really gave me a sense of, you know, that kind of ownership of our budget also, which sometimes, if you're not out there earning it, you don't necessarily feel the same ownership.
Right. So you guys had two ledgers, which in the business world we call having two sets of books. Excellent. Those are great suggestions. You need to come to my next business seminar. And, you know, another thing that Karen brings up is that we all need to kind of understand our own personalities. She was saying that she's a very visual person, and so by using the two ledgers, that really helped her. You know, when Betsy and I went through the process of really sitting down and doing a budget, we came to the conclusion that we would not cut coupons. A, we don't get the newspaper, and B, when we do get the newspaper, I'm not very good at taking the stuff out to recycling, so it just gets piled up. And so I get in trouble, so we cancel the newspaper. And I justify that by saying it saves like 25 bucks a month. But we don't cut coupons, and so we had to figure out other ways that would work for us. And what I found really worked for us was eliminating things that would cost us money rather than being proactive in a number of things. So, for example, like having money withheld from my paycheck, that's not necessarily, I mean, the one time that you go down and you ask them to do that, that's the proactive step. But after that, it's autopilot, right? Another thing is, we used to go to Blockbuster, you know, and especially when Jack was just born, we used to go to Blockbuster every weekend and only rent PG or G-rated movies. And, you know, when you add it up after a little while, it gets expensive. So now we use Netflix. You know, I know this is Sunday school and we're not supposed to talk about Hollywood, but we use it and it's like 10 bucks a month, you know, and that's savings for our family because we are spending twice that at least at Blockbuster.
You could get a family member to work at the library and then you get a break.
Or you could see there again, Jack is not contributing.
75 cents at the library.
But as you get in touch with kind of what works for you and your family and your personality, you can start just making a game of it. If you can save $6 on groceries and that's your contribution, then yeah, that's great. I know that, you know, Betsy does not let me grocery shop. And so she's in charge of all that and she gets mad because I mess it up. I buy the wrong stuff. But, you know, when we said that this is the amount that we could spend on groceries, she comes in under that every month and she tells me about it. And you know what? I'm excited because that's great because we're saving more money. So just having that game plan in place, you know, it makes it a little bit more fun than just kind of being willy-nilly and then at the end of the month saying, where are we at? So let me rush you point four. The roadmap is your budget. And the last 3 weeks of this is going to be practical examples of how to put the budget together and maybe ways to tweak it so that it's not so cumbersome and difficult that you do it for a month and then throw it away. I did email a very simple plan that the California Society of CPAs provides, and Les has already printed it out, and the rest of you get to rush home and do that after church. So there is a budget format. You can just start taking a look at it and start thinking about it. But the purpose of your budget is really to relieve worry, frustration, and anxiety that comes with money and spending. I don't think that it's possible necessarily to completely eliminate that with money. I mean, I feel it at times, you know, and it's one of those things where I try to be faithful and prayerful about those things and say, you know what, it's going to be okay and God's going to provide. But quite frankly, at times, money's just a stressful thing. And so it's nice to have different tools in place that can alleviate that to one degree or another. And as Ray said last week, learn to live on less, maintain that proper perspective, and articulate your goals. Make sure that your goals are articulated, that you're clear on what those are and where you're trying to go. And then your action item five would begin working on your family budget. So just start penciling in those numbers because it's going to take some time to really get a clear picture of what your inflow and your outflow is. I know that for Betsy and I, you know, what we found when we started this process was we took about 6 months of bank statements. And we just downloaded them into a computer program and we used that and we said, okay, this is how we're spending money currently. And that's what we're going to build our budget off. And then future steps are there for your review. Are there other suggestions or recommendations or questions before we completely sign off? I told myself I was going to be done at 10 past, and it's not 10 past. Ray.
Can the private individual invest in this UCBS?
Yes, UBS. but they are like a Morgan Stanley or a TD Ameritrade. UBS is like a Morgan Stanley or a TD Ameritrade. It's just they're investing in mutual funds, basically. Jim?
Beyond your last F there is when you can downsize your home and people call you up, you say, I don't have a mortgage.
Okay, so that's your goal number F. Yeah, exactly. So downsize it and get into situations. I know a lot of people moved out of California in 2003 to 2007 just thinking that they would go move to Iowa and be mortgage-free for the rest of their life. But then you got to live in Iowa. Pastor Schroeder.
I don't need to get into this in the future. What about cash and the use of cash? Sometimes that's tough. And I guess unless you say, here's how much cash we have, now we can know where it's going, eating out fast food, and all this kind of stuff. It's amazing how, you know, where did the money go? It doesn't come in through your bank. It's not on that sheet. So, do you have any thoughts for that?
I don't really spend that much money from our personal account, and I told Betsy that she had to write a check for everything. And so she'd go to the grocery store, and she stayed at lodge. She said that people looked at her like, you realize that there's these little plastic cards you can just swipe through, and this could be done 3 minutes ago. But, you know, that was something that we said that needed to happen because I wanted everything to be on the ledger. And she has a ledger that she actually writes the credit card, she uses a debit card, she writes it in the ledger, which is, I think, something that a lot of people don't do. But if you've got cash and you take it out, you really need to put it in the ledger. And it needs to be a habit of recording where money's going, because you're right. If you spend cash at the end of the month, you know, you don't know where it went. But, you know, Ray has a great suggestion, and that is he just doesn't carry cash. He says he's got, you know, $5 in his wallet at any given time. And, you know, if people say, hey, let's go to the video game arcade, he's like, no, I've only got $5. I'm not going to do that. I'm kidding. He says, I'm not going to go to lunch because nobody asked him to go to the video game arcade. Herman.
They pay everything to the credit card. And they pay a credit card oftentimes, but we get 2% back. So it would be just to me to pay cash.
I think that that's the personality thing. And if you can do that and you can stay on top of it, then do it. And I know Ray and I discussed that when we were talking about planning this thing. The majority of Americans, they end up messing that up, and the credit cards know that, and that's why they put those plans out there. So if you can do it and you can get in the habit that you can do that, more power to you. I've not been able to. Betsy and I used to have a Travelocity card where we get $100 discount on an airline ticket every $8,000 we put on the card. And, yeah. We were lucky to break even at the end of the second year, just based on how that was. So I think that's great if you can do it, but I think that you need to be honest with your personality and yourself. Daphne?
I don't do this, but I know some people who do this. They do strictly cash, you know, except for, you know, the major expenses, and they use, like, the old envelope system where they put, you know, the exact amount they have for each expense that would ordinarily be done cash and pay it that way.
Yeah.
They need to see the actual money, you know, to figure out, you know, how much they really have somehow emotionally, you know.
Sure.
Like the check doesn't work. The debit card certainly doesn't work because that just seems invisible. I don't know. What do you think of that?
It seems, I don't know. I don't really know anybody that's ever done that, but I think that if that's, I mean, if that works for you and that's a system that works, I mean, again, it's a personality thing with whatever is going to work best for you. Brian?
Almost every place will still give you the little slip of paper, or if you went to the movies, you got the ticket stub. I just collect those in my wallet. When they start to get fat, I know I've been spending a pile of them. That seems to me kind of a clutter book, but that's kind of the reverse of what Daphne was saying. One strategy to answer Pastor's question is proactive. You start with those envelopes. You've got to have the discipline of using that envelope to buy that thing. And if you don't have them with you, then maybe it's like Ray, who, you know what, this is my own sales resistance, is that I don't have that resource. If I really want to do this, I drive back home, I get the thing, and then I go do it. You're going to automatically gauge yourself down. So if you if you don't have, you know, a million extra dollars lying around and a goal of eventually getting there, then maybe that doesn't matter to you. But I think that's where it is, too. People in this room are on different places on the spectrum. So if you're at the level of financial distress, then you really need to take the picture like you did of the building earlier. We looked at that for 10 years, and it took a long time to get there, and we've talked about the building every year. And so if you do that as a household and as a family, and you look together, what are your goals? Do you want to be able to travel? Do you want to go to a nicer school? Do you want to drive a newer car someday? And you collect those things out, and you want to tithe that much bigger than your tithing today to build the kingdom. You want to have extra money so that when there's a relief effort, you can give generously in various ways, not just with your sweat, and whatever those things might be. And you reaffirm those with each expense that you make or with some brief review of them. So the flip side of the envelope system would be the pile. And then when you look at those things and you go, these fit in with your 15-minute weekly review of your budget.
Sure. So the pile is another personality alternative.
I have the pile in the drawer system.
And that leads into, if you need professional help, reach out. We're going to be covering, I think, a lot of these subjects in more detail in the coming weeks. So it's half past. So I'm going to pray and we're going to leave. Father, we thank you for this time, this opportunity. We thank you for your worship and we thank you for the service today. We pray that you would bless this day and that you would bless us, that we might serve you even more. Amen.